From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. It is finally Friday, and we'll head into the break room to boldly go where none have gone before.
How close will we come to the nearest Klingon outpost if we continue on our present course?
1 parsec, sir. Close enough to smell them.
That is illogical, Ensign. Odors cannot travel through the vacuum of space.
That's coming up. First, though, Killer Mike added 2 songs to our Georgia playlist yesterday, picking Goody Mob and the Allman Brothers.
You know, as a man, you don't know what it feels like to hurt till you've been heartbroken, man. You know, and the blues let you know that. Like, think about it. When you hear, sometimes I feel, you know, like I've been tied to the whipping post. Good Lord, I feel like I'm dying.
Here are your first thoughts. Rachel Stanley tweets, great reminder from Killer Mike this morning that the best hip-hop albums shake your mind and your booty. Just Off the Radar tweets, not sure which I love more, the Run the Jewels and DJ Shadow single or Killer Mike talking about the Allman Brothers on Second Thought today. Edward Austin Hall wants to know, are instrumental works eligible? Is Fletcher Henderson barred? You know, I always forget that Fletcher Henderson was born here in Georgia. But we want to know what you have to say and your picks for the Georgia playlist as well. You can call us at 404-500-9457, tweet us at OST Talk, or post to Facebook. And Edward, instrumental works are absolutely okay. We might feature your comments on the show. Tomorrow, Delta Airlines will offer flights from Atlanta to Havana, Cuba for the first time in over 50 years. President Obama visited Cuba earlier this year, and he's pushed for the U.S. to normalize relations after decades of separation.
We will end an outdated approach that for decades has failed to advance our interests, and instead, we will begin to normalize relations between our two countries.
But Georgia already has some strong ties to Cuba because we welcomed some of their children. In the early 1960s, 14,000 Cuban kids came to America. One of them was Carmen Bernal, who grew up in Milledgeville, Georgia. She's now a professor of modern and classical languages at Georgia State University, and I spoke with her last July. She shared some of her early memories about Cuba and her journey to Georgia. So when did you get to the U.S.? You were one of the Peter Pan children.
Yes, I am Operation Pedro Pan.
And you were how old when you got here?
I was 13 when I came, and I came on October 4th, 1961.
You obviously remember this really well. Why did your parents let you go? I mean, that must have been a very painful decision for them.
Well, in 1960, many things were changing in Cuba under the regime of Castro. And the parents kind of panicked because there were rumors of an imminent invasion and the children being taken to the fields to cut sugar cane. All of that came true later.
Let me play you a newsreel maybe to take you back in time to that moment. Many people in Cuba viewed Fidel Castro as sort of a conquering hero after the revolution. Take a listen.
Castro rode in glory into Havana. Cubans, hundreds of thousands of them, gave him a hero's welcome. He quickly won international recognition for his government, but later caused widespread concern over his methods.
So your parents, were they were not supporters of Castro?
Yes. They were very, very supportive of Castro. I have here the flag that my mother had in a drawer all the time that Batista was in power, and she got it out on the 1st of January, 1959. Yes. And I wrote at that time. I even wrote in my diary a very detailed account of Castro's coming into Havana.
When you were 13?
When I was 13. I like to write.
So yeah. But they were still afraid of the changes that were coming.
Well, that was 1959.
Right.
By 1960, things had changed a lot. Everything had been nationalized, all the banks. My school was closed, and the nuns were given only 72 hours to leave. That's what changed my mind.
Many of the Catholic schools were close. I wanted to play you a comment from Father Brian Walsh. He was with the Miami Diocese, and he was actually the first person that started. You're nodding your head. Did you meet him?
Yes, of course.
Okay, so he was actually the one that signed the visa waivers for these Cuban kids age 16 and under. Before he died in 2001, Father Walsh spoke with the Florida International University for an oral history project, and he's talking about a call he got from the State Department right before Christmas in 1960. Take a listen.
They had a list of 200 children at the U.S. Embassy in Havana. They were willing to give them visas to come to the United States, provided a non-governmental agency would accept responsibility for them.
So here's another comment, right, that Walsh made. He was asked to do if he himself would sign one of these waiver visas for the kids. And here was his response.
You know, there's no one I can talk to because of the holidays. When do you have to have the answer? And he says, today. So I thought 200 children, save them from communism. It's worth it. So I went out on a limb and agreed to it.
You're saying you remember all of this.
Well, I remember it, and I have read a lot about it. The Reader's Digest had a wonderful article on Monsignor Walsh.
But it went from 200 kids to 14,000.
Exactly. He did not know that at the time.
Yeah. So help me understand how this happened for you. You got word. I assume your parents
yes.
came and told you you'd be
well,
leaving.
Well, actually, the word waiver is a word that I learned a long time after that. It meant no visas. It was just the letter from Father Walsh that would serve as a visa. And these letters were distributed through all the churches in Cuba, not just the Catholic Church.
People were making copies of them.
Yes, and they were being distributed at the churches. So all we needed was a passport and this visa to enter the United States.
Was it your parents that came and said, Carmen, we're sending you to the United States?
Yes. They had been arguing for a few nights. They thought I was asleep when they were arguing.
I am
an only child. My parents were older. It was a very difficult decision for them.
What about you? Were
but
you
the
upset?
Ultimate act of love.
But
courage.
Were you upset? Did you?
Oh, no, I was not upset. I was a free spirit. Most of my friends had already left, and I was very excited. This was an adventure to me. There was never any fear instilled in me about leaving. My parents were very calm, very naturally told me to look for a man named George. That was my only indication. That was the only thing they told me to do.
Look for someone named George.
Their trust in the United States was completely unwavering. They delivered me to heaven on that day.
Okay, so you got to the U.S. You started out in Miami, I assume. So how
yes.
did you end up in Georgia?
Okay, because I stayed at the camp about 6 months. I was probably the longest Peter Pan child that stayed there. Most of them only stay a week or 2 weeks, and then they were relocated. But I had asked to stay, and I had refused a few places, like Montana, for example. I learned these states by looking at this huge map where the children were being relocated. And then in 6 months, the camp was under the hands of social workers. So one day they discovered me, and they told me that I had to either accept a scholarship in New York or live with a relative. By that time, my uncle, a doctor, had arrived in Miami. And against my mother's wishes, I have to say, I chose to go with my uncle. My mother wanted me to go to New York in that scholarship to a Catholic school. But I guess I chose
Why?
The safest
Do you
way.
Remember?
I was afraid of leaving Miami. I did not know then that I was going to end up in Milledgeville, Georgia. And I thought if I left Miami, I was going to be more away from my parents. And I would never see them again. I had that problem. I wanted to stay there. I felt that if I was in Miami, I was closer.
You wanted to keep the ties
yes,
with Cuba.
With my parents,
yeah.
yes. And so he took me out of the camp, and after a year, he was able to pass the board exams and everything, and his first job was in Milledgeville, Georgia, at the state hospital. And that's how we headed north in February of 1963, in a very, very cold day.
Oh, it was cold.
Yes, and gray and gloomy. And I remember seeing the Spanish moss for the first time hanging from the trees. And I imagine myself being entangled in all that, in a gigantic spider web. And these were my feelings as we were heading north.
That sounds scary.
I was not very happy about going to Milledgeville, but Milledgeville was a blessing to me afterwards.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Carmen Bernal. She teaches Spanish at Georgia Perimeter College. Long before that, she was one of the 14,000 Cuban kids who came to the U.S. as part of Operation Peter Pan. Okay, so you got to Milledgeville, and I can't even imagine. Was your English good at this point?
Oh, no, no, no. The first 3 months, I had not studied any English at the camp. On the second 3 months, we had classes, but, you know,
I did
not know
much. What do you remember? I mean, what a culture shock that must have been.
Yes.
What do you remember as kind of sticking out in your memory as things that were really different?
Well, the first culture shock was in Miami. And in the locker room at Shenandoah Junior High, I was not used to changing clothes for PE or anything like that. And also, we were studying Shakespeare in my English class. I remember memorizing without knowing the words. I don't know how I did it. I really don't know how I did it. Anthony's speech of Julius Caesar, that's what we were studying, and I had to write it down. And I knew just a few words, like friends, Romans,
yeah,
countrymen. And so that was difficult. And math and something else and science were manageable at the time.
But, I mean, what about the culture of Georgia where you I assume you couldn't get any kind of food you recognized? People had must
Well,
have...
we had Cuban food at home, remember. I was living in a Cuban home. The main culture shock, it was not a culture shock. It was a blessing. I mean, people really, we were novelties in Milledgeville.
They welcomed
you. The people
you.
In Milledgeville had never seen a Cuban before, and there were 70 Cuban families living in Milledgeville.
70?
70 at the time that I arrived. All the time in the 60s and the 70s, there were 70 Cuban doctors.
Were there other Pedro Pan kids?
No.
You
no, I was
one.
The only one who was not the daughter of the doctor, of a doctor.
I wanted to play you this comment, who was talking about all the numbers. I mean, we're talking 14,000 children.
Yes.
This is George Zamanillo. He's the director of the History Miami Museum. And he's talking about the numbers of Peter Pan kids who became successful.
We have a former senator, Mel Martinez. He's one of Pedro Pan. The mayor of the city of Miami is a Pedro Pan. Many performers and musicians and other successful business people are all Pedro Pan here in the community. It's a great story to tell.
That's not common among people who are refugees, for them to have that large a number of very successful people. And here you are, you're teaching at a university level. I mean, that's success.
Yes, I have taught for 34 years in Georgia.
Why do you think this operation in particular was pretty successful?
I don't know. We, from the time we were little, we were very motivated as far as school was concerned. I mean, there was never a choice of whether you go to college or not after high school. That was different to me. That was very American to have to choose. For us, there was no choice. We were very motivated as far as school was concerned. And I think Monsignor Walsh also did a wonderful job continuing that motivation. He took the place of the parents. And in every message that we got from him, it was important that education was the most important thing. And it became a priority. It was a priority in most of these homes.
Well, but we only have about a minute left, but I have to ask if you did see your parents again.
Yes. Without knowing that it was going to be 4 years, because I came thinking that it was going to be just a short time, I was able to meet my mother in December of 1965.
That was a portion of my interview with Georgia State professor Carmen Bernal. She's one of the 14,000 Cubans who came to the U.S. as part of Operation Pedro Pan. I spoke with her last July. Life has changed dramatically for people with disabilities over the past few decades, but they still face a lot of challenges, and that includes how they're represented both on and off screen. The Disability Studies Initiative at Emory University wants to change that stigma. The group will host the Disability Film Festival tomorrow afternoon on campus. The festival will feature short films and music videos made by and about people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Emory Professor Rosemarie Garland Thompson is founding director of the Disability Studies Initiative at Emory University, and she says the way we view disability must change.
Not long ago, a friend of mine confessed something to me. "I don't think of you as disabled," she revealed. I knew exactly what she meant. I didn't think of myself as disabled either until a few decades ago, even though I was born with 6 fingers and 1 short arm. My friend's comment was meant as a compliment, but it followed a familiar logic. one that African Americans have noted when their well-meaning white friends would say something like, "I don't think of you as black," or when men say to women that she's just one of the guys. This impulse to erase the complications of identity, while usually well-meaning, clashes with the various pride movements we've come to know in recent decades. Slogans like "Black is beautiful" and "We're here, we're queer, get used to it" have become transformative taunts for generations of people who have lived with the self-loathing of racism, sexism, and discrimination. Yet pride movements for people with disabilities have not gained the same sort of traction. Why? One answer is that we have a much clearer understanding of what it means to be a woman or an African American, gay or transgendered person, than what it means to be disabled. A person without a disability may recognize someone using a wheelchair, a prosthetic limb, or someone with Down syndrome, but most don't see these people as having a shared social identity and political status. They seem to be people who had something unfortunate happen to them, something gone terribly wrong. But one thing most people do know about being disabled is that they don't want to be that. Yet, most of us will move in and out of disability in our lifetimes. Whether we do so through illness, an injury, or merely the process of aging, most Americans don't know how to be disabled. Since most of us will enter into disability as we travel through life, we aren't used to it in the way most of us are with our gender or our race. Yet disability, like any challenge or limitation, is fundamental to being human. It's a part of every life. Clearly, the border between us and them, then, is fragile. We might just be better off preparing for disability than fleeing from it. Before I learned about disability rights and disability pride, I always had to squirm out a shame-filled, "I was born that way," when people asked me what had happened to me. But now, I'm likely to begin one of these uncomfortable encounters with, "I have a disability," and to complete it with, "And these are the accommodations that I need." Becoming disabled demands learning how to live effectively as a person with disabilities, not just living as a disabled person trying to become non-disabled. It also demands the awareness and cooperation of others who don't experience these challenges. Becoming disabled means moving from isolation to community, from ignorance to knowledge about who we are, from exclusion to access, and from shame to pride.
That's Emory University Professor Rosemarie Garland-Thompson. She is founding director of the Disability Studies Initiative at Emory University. She read an adapted version of her New York Times column called "Becoming Disabled." The link to the full commentary is available at gpbnews.org.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
It's been a long week. We've talked about the dental crisis here in Georgia. We talked about Whisperin' Bill Anderson, and we caught up with Atlanta rap artist Killer Mike. So as we do every Friday, we've gathered together a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened this week. Let's go into the break room.
Atlanta music icon Gladys Knight has filed a lawsuit against her son. She is demanding he stop using her name immediately.
The 11 herbs and spices mixture has been a mystery locked in a corporate vault. But a nephew in Kentucky showed it to a reporter researching a story on Colonel Sanders.
The Starship Enterprise was a metaphor for Starship Earth, the diversity of this planet.
Joining us this morning, psychology professor Roxanne Donovan of Kennesaw State University, Jeff Breedlove, communications director for DeKalb County Commissioner Nancy Jester, former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr, and joining us from Savannah, Jessica Lee Libos. She's the community editor of Connect Savannah. Hi, Jessica.
So happy to be here again. Thanks, Celeste.
And hello, everyone who's here in Atlanta.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
All right. Our table, if you were here, you would see it's much too large for me to reach anybody's hands. But let's talk about handshakes because they're important, and especially in political seasons.
What's this that? I hear about you not shaking your constituents' hands? You can't do that.
No, you don't understand, Jeff. She gave me a cough and shake.
Sure, it wasn't a cough and a wipe and a shake?
No, there was no wipe, definitely no wipe. She didn't have the decency to give me a wipe.
wipe or not, handshakes are getting weaker. A recent study in the Journal of Hand Therapy shows smartphones are actually weakening our hands. The study found the typical 30 to 34-year-old man in 1985 could squeeze your hand with 31 pounds of force, 31 pounds more force than the typical woman of 1985. Today, older millennial men and women are roughly equal when it comes to grip strength, and their handshakes are weaker. So, do we see this as a problem or just a change?
I don't know if that it's due to the smartphone. I don't know how they
came up. Oh, you don't buy that.
That it came up with that. I think it was something that was taught. It was taught in our family and schools that you need to have a firm handshake. That was said something about you as a person, that you were a serious person. And I even found a guide to how to be a great handshaker.
That's hilarious.
A recent guide. Which means it must be true. Must be needed.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I see.
Well, I've been working on campaigns before. I've read poll crosstabs, where people have commented, the candidate didn't have a strong handshake and that didn't impress the voter. And so I do think maybe among a certain generation that is important and it impacts the perception they have of people. Of course, my son's 16 years old and we do a lot of fist bumps and these complicated handshakes that I can't really keep up with anymore. Things are changing in that generation.
That. Yeah. Jessica, what do you think?
Well, I have to say that limp fish handshake is a huge pet peeve of mine. Go to shake somebody's hand and it's this, but we are the fist bump generation coming up. So I was thinking maybe if they sort of gave out stress balls that strengthen hands with every smartphone, maybe that would sort of combat the issue.
I'm in favor of stress balls for several reasons.
I think I might need a stress ball now. I don't know if I want someone to shake my hand with 31 pounds of force. That seems pretty excessive, but I have an issue with the wet noodle handshake too. I have assumptions about unassertiveness, lack of tenacity, and then I try really hard to get those assumptions out of my head. But I think a firm handshake does project assertiveness and tenacity, and maybe it's because I'm of a certain generation, but that's where I'm at.
And I would say, now that I'm approaching the older phase, I agree with you. Young kids that come in for job interviews and they're interviewing with older people, those people have an expectation of a first impression, what a handshake would be like. And I do think it's important to millennials to be situational when they're interviewing with older people in job situations to know you don't want to make a bad first impression unintentionally.
That's fair enough, whether you agree with it or not. That's the truth. All right, so let's move on from handshakes to maybe finger looking good.
Just look for the containers that say KFC on them. There's always something good in there.
Dude, that's birds in there. You're eating another bird.
No.
You're eating a bird. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
No. Okay, so it's no secret that they are birds. But the recipe, the 11 herbs and spices, has been very closely guarded for a very long time. Turns out a freelance writer might have stumbled on the recipe. That writer, the reporter, was interviewing a nephew of Colonel Sanders. They took a picture of the nephew with a scrapbook in the picture. And in the background of that photo, you see a recipe with, coincidentally, 11 herbs and spices that was published in the Chicago Tribune. Now, in an email to the Courier Journal, a KFC spokesperson says that is not their recipe. Okay. But real or not real, have you ever accidentally revealed a secret that you shouldn't have?
Oh, I did it all the time when I was a kid. I was a complete blabbermouth.
Oh,
secrets
you were?
From the family, secrets that I was told. When I was in training to be a psychologist, though, I learned how to keep secrets and not say things.
Yeah,
and
that's
I
kind
developed
of important.
A very contextual memory, so I would forget until I saw that person again, then I would remember.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah, that's how my brain works.
That's an interesting tactic.
Yeah.
I am on the side of keeping my mouth shut, though.
Jessica, you do the contextual thing, or you're a blabbermouth?
Well, no, I have a terrible memory. So somebody tells me something, and I just kind of forget about it. But again, I hear the words off the record an awful lot. So I like to think of myself as a pretty good secret keeper, whether consciously or unconsciously.
I'm good at keeping secrets as long as people tell me it's a secret. I've had a problem with, you know, having a conversation and then telling someone and then the person comes, I can't believe you told that person I got, including my sister, I can't believe you told that person I got a job. Did you tell me not to?
Yeah, see, that's the problem with journalists. I'm like, it's all on the record unless you say it's off.
Exactly.
What about you?
So let me know.
Well, I think I'm like Jessica. You know, I can't remember half the things anyway. So I innocently, like, I don't know. But I will say, you know, I started working in politics, and I was always scared to death that if I said the wrong thing, I'd get fired. Mm. So I think I grew up in an environment where it was just safer to be more discreet and keep your mouth shut. So I was just always scared to death to lose my job. So I think that helped me learn how to keep a secret professionally.
That's understandable. And certainly that's something I would want to hear from the listeners. Definitely. I mean, look, if you already gave away the secret, there's no harm in telling us now. So let us know.
But I want to say about KFC, you know, I always thought their secret recipe was in the same vault that Coca-Cola's was maybe or something.
Coca-Cola. There you go. Coca-Cola. Well,
that's a true Georgia pronunciation.
It's in the vault.
I was pretty shocked to see that like white pepper was the most provocative thing on there because I was pretty sure it was going to be some unpronounceable chemical, which like the same
well,
thing
no,
that turns
when the
McDonald's
Kernel
French fries
working,
into crack.
Yeah. Anyhow, okay. So one thing to do this weekend, if you are in Macon-Bibb County, is to head to a gun auction. For the first time there, the sheriff will auction off guns that were seized by police officers. That includes up to 90 weapons, pistols, rifles, shotguns. Those guns used to be crushed and then recycled. State law now requires that they be auctioned to the public. What do you think?
Bad idea. I'm sorry. Really bad idea. I know that the county departments want the money from, you know, they're trying to fund some of their work, but I mean, this could be and has, in fact, put some weapons back on the street that have been involved in other crimes. It's a state law, and I know also that at least 10 other states have passed this kind of law. So I'm not exactly sure what the impetus is behind this law.
Yeah, I have to agree. I don't understand what the impetus behind these kinds of laws would be. I really think that there should be less guns on the streets, period. And you know, the idea of crushing them gleefully, like the same way they burn bales of marijuana, you know, it would be a way for them to go, in my opinion. I don't like to see guns put back on the streets, even if they are antiques and the collectibles. It's just, I think it's a bad idea.
Well, Jeff, maybe you can enlighten us on the impetus.
The first thing I want to say, if you're going to Macon or you're in Macon, go to Fincher's Barbecue and get some good barbecue while you're down there. But no matter
armed
what side of the issue
you're on,
armed or not, it's really good barbecue. But in all seriousness, listen, guns aren't the problem. Criminals are the problem. We have a Second Amendment right. Taxpayers have every right to expect their government to work for them. And I think it makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense for law enforcement, who we trust to verify the gun is getting into a law-abiding citizen's hand, to be the intermediary. Law enforcement encourages people, for example, if you're doing an eBay trade or Craigslist thing, come and make sure you do it in our parking lot, and we'll make sure everything's okay.
Though they'll do the same thing if it's
a
toaster.
So we know these guns will get to the hands of law-abiding citizens. And let me tell you, there's nothing wrong with a gun in the hand of a law-abiding citizen.
Just very quick fact check is that, in fact, the vast majority of people who are injured by a gun is accidental, not through a criminal act. That's just the fact. I want to be clear there. Roxanne?
There is just great irony in a public safety agency, in a law enforcement agency selling high-capacity guns, selling guns at all, getting in the gun sale business. And I just,
What if it's an antique? What if it's a collector's item? I just can't wrap
my mind around it, especially at the possibility that those guns are going to be problematic for the very people who are selling them.
But the guns aren't problematic. Criminals are problematic.
So the criminals or the people who accidentally set off these guns, the fact that the Association of Police Chiefs are calling for greater gun control, rational gun control, like expanded background checks, for example, yet there are sales now in sheriff offices.
Of confiscated guns.
Gee, police chiefs are never political and never push an agenda. I mean.
Well, also, you know, there are states that turn these guns over to a central clearinghouse. Some police departments have melted them down in the past, which was actually, and I know in St. Louis, they made a statue out of these.
And all that's kind of silly because gun buyback programs have never been proven to work to save one life. Neil Bortz was talking just the other day about some research he had done And gun buyback programs, frankly, it can be argued, are a complete waste of taxpayer dollars.
They get guns off the streets. They get some guns off the streets.
And out of the hands of those criminals that you're talking about.
Again, it's not the criminals that are the most dangerous. Last year, a toddler in America shot someone accidentally once a week on average. So
it's complicated.
It is complicated, and there are good arguments on both sides. So this is a discussion that continues. It is Friday. We are hanging out in the break room. My guests are Kennesaw State University Professor Roxanne Donovan, former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr, Jeff Breedlove of the Office of DeKalb County Commissioner Nancy Jester, and down in Savannah, Jessica Lee Labos, Connect Savannah Community Editor. I need to fact check myself. Every once in a while, we don't have a break room, so it's not every single Friday. Anyhow, we want to say thank you. Fact checked everybody else. I got to fact check myself. Yeah. We want to say thank you to Savannah Coffee Roasters. Speaking of Savannah, they donate the coffee that our break room guests sip on and I sip on every morning. They are online at savannahcoffee.com. Okay, let's get back into it. Some 70,000. Speaking of Star Trek, science fiction and fantasy lovers gathered in Atlanta last weekend for Dragon Con. There were amazing costumes. If you went to the parade, you know that. But a lot of people think one couple went too far. They dressed up as the World Trade Center, engulfed in flames from September 11th, and their costume even had Barbies dangling out the windows. So, A, can a costume go too far? And will we ever be in a position where it's okay to joke about 9/11? Jeff?
So I've been to Dragon Con many times, been to the parades. My niece was there this year. She stayed with us. Yes, a costume can go too far. I was very impressed by the statement Dragon Con put out and the actions that they took. That was, we have people today who were first responders, who are still alive, who are dying a slow death from all the chemicals that they inhaled. It's not over yet, and it impacted all of us. And I will tell you this, that was as offensive, I think, to people as if someone had dressed up in blackface or if someone had gone as a Jew making fun of the Holocaust. I mean, yes, you can go too far, and these people went too far. Dragon Con, I think, took appropriate steps, and it was disgusting.
They have a right to wear the costume, but it was so hard to look at the pictures of it because of the collective trauma that was experienced during 9/11, the individual trauma for the people who lost family members and who had to bear witness to what occurred. It was offensive, it was in bad taste, and we live in a country where this is possible. Like, you can do it.
Sure, I mean, I agree. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. Mm-hmm. I'm sure these people had sat around thinking that they were incredibly clever, and they probably laughed and thought they were really funny, and they thought that somebody was going to appreciate it. If they were surprised at the reaction that they got, they are, borderline personalities, because, you have to really not be paying attention to the climate of this country and the reaction to 9/11 and how raw 15 years later it still is. Mm-hmm. But that said, there are people out there making Holocaust jokes all the time. And there are, it wasn't that long ago that Prince Harry showed up in a Nazi uniform at a costume party. So, I don't know how long we may end up in 50 years, 75 years with people not appreciating the depth of this tragedy. And that's very, very sad. I don't know if anybody else saw, but there was a mattress company who put out a local commercial and had their twin towers for their twin mattresses, and the towers of mattresses falling over. They thankfully got the same reaction. People were outraged. It's too soon, and it will be too soon for a very, very long time.
Well, a Florida Walmart. Coca-Cola put a display up, and this morning it was announced by Coca-Cola that they and Walmart took that down, and they apologized. They said it was meant to honor firefighters, but the reaction in that community was there's outrage, and apologies from Walmart and Coca-Cola have been issued this morning.
Well, let's move on to something a little less depressing. Dragon Con was also timed very well and allowed everyone to celebrate one of the greatest science fiction series there is that turned 50 this year.
These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its 5-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations. to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Okay, so this is my call out to listeners because I want to hear your impressions. It doesn't have to be of Captain Kirk, but we want to hear your Star Trek impressions. You need to call us and leave a message with your best Star Trek impressions at 404-500-9457. That said, happy birthday to Star Trek. Let's talk about what we think the impact of the show has been on American culture.
Hey, the communicator is in our hand right now.
Yeah,
that's true.
And has been for a while. So, but, I mean, it still captivates people's imaginations, I think. It was a time when, I mean, the show dealt with conflict and war and race issues and friendship. And I think that's why it's still relevant today.
And at a time when there was the civil rights movement, there was the second wave feminism, and TV didn't reflect any of that. People of color were shown in stereotypical ways. And here in Star Trek, this groundbreaking show with Sulu and O'Hara, and the fact that kids could look to this TV show, Kids of Color, and see a reflection of a future that had racial harmony, I think that was impactful. That was the kiss heard around the world, right, Jeff? Amazing social commentary.
Right.
Star Trek has lived long, and it has prospered, and it has changed the world. And I mean, you go to the Smithsonian or to NASA, you see displays of how scientists were inspired by what they saw on the show to make everything.
He's holding up
now.
His cell phone. We're on radio,
and,
Jeff.
I know. but more than this, I mean, medicines and things like that. And so it has inspired in a positive way. I had the privilege of meeting a lot of these actors and Gene Roddenberry at a Star Trek event. And one of the things Mr. Roddenberry said, the thing he was most nervous about, it wasn't the African-American portrayal. It was putting a Russian on the deck because we were also in the Cold War.
True that.
And that was very hot. And they were very, very nervous of how America would react to that.
Listening to that
was fascinating.
You know, my apologies. Sorry, Jeff.
Sorry.
You're not there. I can't see you.
Right.
Well, I do think that, I mean, what Star Trek did starting in the 1960s, it showed us a universe that was possible, that a peaceful existence was possible for all of humanity, that we could rise above our nationalism and our racism and our gender issues and all. And it still resonates today because we're still working on those things. And many of us are still looking for that universe and believe in it. And I think that's why it continues to have an impact. But I don't know how many of you saw the latest Star Trek Beyond. Anybody?
Yes.
Me, yes.
Yeah. Jeff's raising his hand. He hasn't gotten the radio thing.
Said yes.
I was a little disappointed because I feel like it didn't tackle all those themes so much. I thought it was a little bit rote, but hopefully it has many, many more chances to continue exploring where no human has gone before.
Okay, so let's move on to from a timeless show to timeless music, right? I mean, that's fair enough to say about Gladys Knight. The soul music legend is now suing to remove her name from the iconic Atlanta Chicken and Waffles restaurant. That restaurant is owned by her son, but he faces theft charges at this point after the Georgia Department of Revenue raided the eatery. That suit by Knight includes an email from her son's attorney, and it says the son has no desire to fight his mother for use of her name, end quote. And here's the thing. Is it always a bad idea to go into business with family?
It's risky.
I mean, it worked out for Motown, right? But most of the time it goes bad.
Families have baggage. Even the best families among us have baggage. And there's communication issues, typically multi-generational issues. And going into business adds a whole layer on top of that. And for businesses to work, there has to be open communication, ability to take critique, and it can be hard when there are soft spots as it relates to family. It can be really difficult, not impossible.
Our soft spots are your kid
triggers,
stealing a bunch of money.
Triggers.
Well, that would be, well, you can't control people's actions. And, eventually they may reflect poorly on you as Gladys Knight at this point.
And then suddenly money breaks up a family. What do you think, Jessica?
Well, you know, I mean, again, I come from a long line of doctors, so unless somebody's opening up like a hurt feelings clinic, I'm not going into in business with anybody. But, you know, I have to say, I mean, I've always envied families that do have multi-generational businesses. There are several businesses in Savannah that I admire very much that where, you know, people my age are taking over businesses that their grandparents started, and it seems to be working out very well. But I just hope Ms. Knight took back the recipes as well, because, not just her name.
Oh, you've been there. You've eaten there.
Yeah, they're delicious. The chicken and waffles.
Okay, so we are hanging out in the break room this morning. You just heard the voice of Jessica Lee Labos, of community editor of Connect Savannah. We're also talking to Kennesaw State University professor Roxanne Donovan, former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr, and Jeff Breedlove of Nancy Jester's office of the DeKalb County Commissioner. Okay. President Obama has a push for diversity in courtrooms, and that has continued. He's just nominated a Muslim judge to the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. That would be the first Muslim to sit on a federal bench. Meanwhile, Wednesday, the NAACP challenged Alabama's practice of electing appellate judges statewide by statewide vote and saying that it has resulted in all-white courts. That's in a state where one out of every four persons is African American. So here's the question. Should diversity matter when it comes to judges? But if justice is supposed to be blind, should it matter who's sitting on the bench?
The only thing that should matter is the judge or justice impartial and blind and interpreting law and not legislating law. And, you know, would the NAACP, would they be upset in another state if we had the first historical all African American court, but they all of a sudden want to change in an investigation? It's not about the way people look. It's about the way people act. And it's about their character. And we need justices that are blind and only interpret the law and enforce it fairly.
And I think that's an ideal that doesn't bear out a lot, because lots of psychological evidence suggests that we have in-group preferences and we sometimes unconsciously have out-group preferences and out-group beliefs. So we're likely to believe people that look like us, that have our background, we see them more favorably, and people who don't look like us, who don't share our backgrounds, we view them less favorably. And there's mounds and mounds of evidence that we can hold these biases even if we don't want to.
Right.
They come out in unconscious ways. So I'm with you from an ideal perspective, but the reality that our positionality impacts how we treat other people. And that becomes really problematic when only one set of people or judges are representing more the majority group than they are the minority group. And then those positionalities are impacting how the justice system works.
We have a couple tweets here. Sam Burnham says Jeff Breedlove is getting it done in the break room today. And then Robbie Medwood says, yes, we absolutely need more diversity in the courts, in government, in law enforcement, in every place, everywhere.
I think it does. It shouldn't matter. I think it does matter because I think people don't believe that many times that the judicial system represents them. And I think that's the issue. There was a
Seen a lot of bias in sentencing.
And even registered voters, according to a New York State Marist poll, say that poor people, racial minorities, and non-English-speaking people who are going through the court system, they believe that they receive worse treatment by judges.
And there's evidence to support that.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, let's move on to talk about dogs. It might make people smile a little bit, except that bulldogs, while being some of the sweetest creatures out there and very slobbery, they still get a pretty bad rap.
Consider the bulldog, a grotesque monstrosity born of relentless inbreeding, riddled with sinusitis, crippled by joint pain, chronically flatulent. A kindly pet or humanity's cruelest mistake?
Okay, so we talked in the break room before about this study from the UC Davis that said breeding among bulldogs has made them prone to early death. The Humane Society called bulldogs the poster child for breeding gone awry. The new wrinkle is that in order to solve this or address this problem, UGA's breeder wants to add a little diversity into the mostly pure breeding line they've used. But look, here's the thing. If overbreeding, we know it is hurting not just bulldogs, but all kinds of dogs. We know that it's not good for them. Why don't we just stop breeding? Why don't we just get dogs from the shelter, for example?
I agree. I've had three shelter dogs. I love them. I think we could train shelter dogs to be mascots for universities. We don't have, I mean, I don't know, but there are a lot of people that believe that purebred dogs are the best dogs. I disagree.
Well, I agree with Kathy. I mean, I'm a rescue family, and you know, of all the topics we've talked about, I'm scared to death of most of this one because I don't want Bulldog Nation mad at us.
Right,
go
dogs,
win Saturday. But in all seriousness, we've all seen the Uggas lately, and it's very sad. Short lifespans. They have to sit on ice during the games because the dogs themselves deserve better. And I would prefer that the University of Georgia move to a system of rescue dogs. But if they are going to breed, they owe it to those dogs to do it in the most humane way possible.
I am all for a shelter Ugga. I think that would be a wonderful message to send, that Dog Nation can send to the rest of the country. I mean, bulldogs can't breed without human intervention. They're 95% are born by cesarean.
They can't now, because of human breeding. Yeah.
So, I mean, if you're going to introduce a breed and breed them to be stronger and introduce, like, I don't know what you would introduce into the Ugga's bloodline that would... I don't know. I mean, would it couldn't be a Doberman? Would you put a little pug in there?
The Doberman. The state of Georgia did adopt a law that the official dog of Georgia is the adoptable dog. It would be a great message to send to support that law that, you know, we want to encourage adoption and rescue dogs.
And we need a larger conversation about breeding these animals in this way. We all know genetic diversity is better. It creates more adaptable animals. It creates animals with less issues. And why are we not creating policy to support these animals?
Yeah, I hate to see them suffer.
Me too. I agree.
We are out of time in the break room today. I want to say thank you to all my guests. You just heard Kennesaw State University professor Roxanne Donovan. We also had former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr with us, and Jeff Breedlove, who's communications director for DeKalb County Commissioner Nancy Jester, and in Savannah, Connect Savannah community editor Jessica Lee Labos. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy Friday.
Yay. Happy Friday to you.
Go dogs.
Go dogs. Sure, trying to get your plug in there before you get angry emails. That's our show for today, but let's put that out to you as well. If breeding is hurting dogs, maybe we should stop doing it. Not just the University of Georgia, but maybe we should stop breeding dogs that are born to be unhealthy. What do you think? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter. It's at OST Talk, or I am at Celeste Headley. You can also post to Facebook. For today and the week that is on Second Thought from GPB News, I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.